Hi everyone, it's story time. My name is Raquel Romano. I'm a software engineer at the United States Digital Service, which you'll hear more about. And I am also the engineering lead at our digital service team at the Department of Veteran Affairs. And I'm going to sketch for you a fictional day in my life as a software developer in government. When I left Google after about 10 years of software engineering there, pretty much everyone I knew was completely baffled. Why would you do that? Why would you leave Google to work for the government? And I did it during interesting times. And I feel like sometimes stories are just the best way to explain why I would want to do that, and why maybe you'll be able to see why government desperately needs people with skills like yours to come, and that it can actually be gratifying to work at a little startup in the middle of the federal government. So it's a beautiful fall, crisp fall day in the San Francisco Bay Area. I wake up, get the kids off to school, sit down with a cup of coffee, and see what my colleagues in Washington, D.C. have been up to while I was asleep. And I'm particularly excited today because we're starting new development on a feature that's been something we wanted to do for a long time, which is to make it easier for veterans who have suffered an injury during military service and are in need of compensation for their disabilities. It's notoriously hard right now to do that. You would think, hey, you served, you were injured, Uncle Sam will take care of you. It's true, but it's really hard. Think about it like filing your taxes, except it could take months, it could take years. And many veterans actually just go get an attorney or representative to help them through it because it's so complicated. So we're trying to make it really easy. And the platform that we're doing it on is called vets.gov. You'll hear a little more about it from me later. You'll be surprised to know that we're developing it in a reasonably modern way. It's actually really unremarkable. We're developing it the way you would probably see any startup develop something like this, but it's pretty unusual for a federal government. For example, we have a thin Rails API. It fetches data about a veteran from any number of back-end systems in the VA that have been alive for any number of years. It serves it to a React client that was designed with veterans to make it as straightforward to do some of these really tedious and sometimes emotionally draining things that are vital to their well-being. So I log in, check my pull request that I sent last night. It was approved, which is kind of nice that sometimes things happen while you're asleep. Can hit the ground running. So I go ahead and submit it, wait for Jenkins. Instead of waiting for Jenkins to build it, test it, merge it, deploy it to our staging environment, I go off to see what else I can do. And I get a page from PagerDuty. So all the front-end and back-end engineers on our team are all on rotations, which has worked out well. We run rotations for all the products that we have built. And it's great. Our DevOps folks are our secondaries for those and for those rotations. And so if we're initially a little bit clueless because we're developers and we haven't done DevOps before, it's okay. We just learn on the job. So life is good. We have all the tools and processes that we need to build products that we actually care really deeply about and are passionate about. So I say, I'm going to dig into this alert. And as I start to look at this fictional incident that is maybe based on real life events, all of the tools and processes that I'm used to that made life so sweet seem to fade away. You see, this alert, it has to do with a production service, a back-end service that my team doesn't really have any control over, even though we have live products right now that receive data from it and save data to it, send data to it. And it lives in a world that we didn't build, but we have to visit it more often than we'd like to, because our product kind of relies on its infrastructure, which you can see above. And here's some more facts about this world. Unfortunately, we don't have any shared ticketing system with the team that maintains this service. Let's call them Team A. So updates to any incident are pretty much siloed. Actually, all our communications about incidents are via email. The good thing is there is already an email thread about this. It's a little long, and it explains that this alert is that our calls to their service have been timing out. Some of them are taking up to 15 seconds, which is crazy long. Every time we ping the thread, they say, "Are you sure it's still a problem?" And we attach another screenshot of a Prometheus log and say, "Yeah, look, it's really a problem." So Unfortunately, this thread has 50 messages. It's got 30 people that have been mostly added for awareness to it. It dates back a few months, and it's pretty neglected, like the roads in this picture. So we actually just decided to get all developers on a phone call and talk a little bit about it. And then we start to understand why it is this way. So unfortunately, Team A, who are really perfectly capable and good developers and engineers, they didn't build this. It was developed by a separate team, Team B, at a separate company, and they polished it to perfection, and they deployed it in a beautiful staging environment, and it was working splendidly, and their contract doesn't let them touch it as soon as it hits production. So we go back to production. Production doesn't actually look like this, but the tooling in production kind of looks like this. So Team A steps in, and that'd be fine, because like I said, they're capable, except we've said, hey, here's some timestamps. Can you check out which ones are timing out? And they're like, oh yeah, you know, we can't query our logs with just a timestamp because actually they inherited like hundreds of systems and they are all writing logs to 1 7-terabyte table. And so even if they query by timestamp, they'd get back tens of thousands of records, and then that would like adversely affect production. And so we're like, okay, no, never mind. Don't do that. The other sad thing is that even if they wanted to change how logging is done, they actually don't have access to the source code right now because somehow they were given the responsibility to maintain this without an actual like development environment to work on it. That's changing, but hey, at least they have source code. When I first joined the VA, I started working on a project. We were replacing some forms that were 15 years old, and upgrades couldn't actually be made to those because the source code was lost. So at least it's not lost. Try to look at the bright side. There is a bright side. The bright side is that they were able to look at the fan out of these services and find out there's like plenty of other backend legacy services and find which one was contributing to this latency. And we got them, Team C, from a different company on the phone, and they're really excited. They're like, well, yeah, let's figure this out together. We don't want to be in these horrible threads either. Like, and let's try to get to the bottom of this. And they identified some ways that like their services were being inefficiently called, and ultimately, yeah, I'm not going to end this painful thread today. I'm not going to fully resolve this, but there is this willingness across government by developers and people who want to deliver better services to veterans and to people who use government services. And Matt's going to tell you more.
Cool.
You want this?
Sure. And we will be tag teaming throughout this. My name is Matt Cutts. I'm the acting administrator of the U.S. Digital Service. So you might know the USDS as the group of geeks that helped rescue healthcare.gov. You might remember when Mikey Dickerson gave a talk at LISA a couple years ago. But we're actually working on a lot of different projects with a lot of different agency partners. Okay, so I will start out with one specific horror story, which is I joined Google back in 2000. I was actually at Google for 16 years, going on 17, whenever I came to the U.S. Digital Service. And whenever I joined, I was a very fresh, wet, behind-the-ears, green software engineer. And I actually spent about a year in the advertising group when it was 5 engineers. And so I was doing a code review for an engineer named Ed. And I noticed that Ed had 2 functions. And even though he broke both functions, he was checking the data that he was passing from the sending function to the receiving function. And as a completely green engineer, I was like, well, but you wrote both functions. You know the data that's going to be transmitted. Why do you need to check it on that second receiving function? And Ed, who is Yoda in this story, was basically like, no, let me tell you a little thing about something called feature creep, or how functions can morph over time. And so the fact of the matter is that none of my functions trust any of my other functions. So this was just an example of something called Postel's Law. Whenever you're writing a computer system, you want to be very conservative in what you output, but you want to be able to be very liberal in what you accept and sanity check it and make sure that you aren't getting data that's weird or out of bounds. Now, this is a relatively well-known law, but it's always nice to have a reminder about the importance of it. So this story is about a government system that did not respect Postel's Law. Service treatment records allow medical information to flow from the Department of Defense to the Department of Veterans Affairs. So in theory, all of this information should transfer really smoothly when you finish your military service. You will be surprised to learn that that is not always the case. And this has a real cost. This is Emerson. He's a combat veteran. We met him in Oklahoma City. He gets driven 2 hours to go to a VA facility. So if you're a vet who might have to drive more than that, you really want to show up and be able to make sure that your records are actually there when you're trying to get healthcare. Otherwise, you might miss out on a life-saving treatment. Okay, so data is supposed to flow. I don't know if I can walk and talk. Let's see. Don't get any feedback. All right, great. Data is supposed to flow smoothly from the DoD to the VA, Veterans Affairs. The problem is, whenever a doctor was going to export medical records, they had a choice, a drop-down, and they could export in PDF, TIFF, or JPEG. What do you think the right answer was? Well, the right answer is to have it electronic, right, and native, so that you don't have to worry about that at all. But in this case, the right answer was to export as a PDF. If the doctor selected JPEG or TIFF, that service treatment record would be silently dropped. Yes, it wouldn't make it to the VA at all. And so when a veteran would show up, they'd say, hey, I served in Iraq or Afghanistan. I would like to get some of my health benefits. People would be like, we've never heard of you before. Because a doctor selected the wrong drop-down when they were exporting data. So we saw 5% of veterans incorrectly getting benefits from this particular bug during this particular range of time. It also took 3 months to transfer medical records and 18 months between system upgrades. So we had a guy, his name was Chris Lynch, and he didn't think that he can have a big impact in the government. He said, I will give you 44 days. I will come to the US government for 44 days. And Todd Park, the CTO of America, said, okay, that's great. Work on this service treatment record problem. In 44 days, they got it down to 0% of veterans incorrectly denied benefits. They got it down to 1 day to transfer medical records and 2 weeks between system updates. So that's the kind of impact that people can have. And it's important to remember, this affects people's lives. This has concrete costs if you want to interact with the federal government and it doesn't behave the way that it should. Can you imagine showing up at a VA facility and being told, sorry, we lost your records? Just imagine the nightmare of red tape and bureaucracy that you would be faced with to try to figure out, okay, now what do I do? It's like dealing with IRS taxes on steroids, trying to figure out how to navigate that system. And that was from a single bug. Okay, let's hand it back to Raquel to talk about vets.gov.
So I mentioned earlier about a platform called vets.gov, and I want to give you a little bit of background about how it came to be. So if I'm a veteran, I have over 500 options of websites I might be able to visit and over 1,000 toll-free numbers I might be able to call in order to interact with the Department of Veteran Affairs to get something that I need. And I might have to keep track of 7 different usernames and passwords for different types of systems with different names and designs and different behaviors and branding. And if that wasn't enough, some of the systems just aren't the easiest to use. So, for example, here's a story about something called the 1010 Easy, which wasn't very easy, by the way. And it's an application for health benefits, so it's pretty important. Like, I need health care. The problem with it was that the form you see here, about three-quarters of veterans who needed to apply for health care were doing it in person. Around 15% were applying by mail, paper, and only 10% were applying online. And it turns out that this application was a fillable PDF. That was the only online application at the time. And it could only be opened with an old version of Adobe Acrobat. And most traffic to government websites comes from Safari, Firefox, and Chrome. And most of those browsers' default PDF viewers are not an old version of Adobe. So instead of seeing this arguably usable form, most people would see this. An error message that says, you can't read this. And not surprisingly, most people just gave up at this point. Very few people were actually submitting things online. So we used a cutting-edge technology called a web form. No. We're not the first people to use a web form in government. It's there, but this one was really overdue for that. That was sort of one of the first services that we put on this platform, vets.gov. And some of the principles behind it were, it has to be responsive. It works on mobile, it works on tablets. It has to be accessible. If you're blind or low vision, it works with a screen reader. It's just got to be easier to fill out. It has to have plain language, so many things. And the error, when we launched this, error rates plummeted from about 70% of people encountering errors to less than 0.01%. So it was clearly a success. And other things about it beforehand, like I said, it took, not only were very few people doing this online, but the ones who were doing it with paper, it took them like over 100 days to process that. And now suddenly we were getting, instead of like less than 100 online applications per day, over 500, and this is with zero promotion whatsoever. We had 50% of applications coming in online and growing, and essentially people just saying, wow, this is really easy. I really didn't know it was possible for something to be this easy in government. Thank you, which is really gratifying. And as the beginning of vets.gov, the platform's mission, it was really to have a single place where a veteran could discover, apply for, track, and manage all of the things that it needs from the VA. And this is a whiteboard from our DC office that is, this picture's actually out of date. We're checking boxes off month by month and trying to make it so that you really only need one set of credentials and go to one place to do everything you will ever need to interact with the Veterans Affairs Department. We're also following in the footsteps of USDS and 18F, who have worked on realizing that like there are about 30,000 government websites, all with completely different looks and feels, and so they published a library of design patterns with code to implement them to help there be not uniformity. We don't want every site to be the same, but at least consistency, so people can not have to like relearn how to use each new system. And so we're doing that at the VA as well, specifically for things that help veterans. And one last point I want to make. There will always be paper. There are people who need to use paper, and that will always be an option. But to not forget the value of being able to file something digitally. Matt mentioned a veteran possibly having to drive for hours to do something in person. The form on the left, some people would have to do this in person. If you're in a rural area, you'd have to drive 4 to 5 hours to get to a VA facility. And on vets.gov, we replace this whole form with a checkbox, and it happens instantly.
All right, so one of my favorite authors is William Gibson, and one of my favorite quotes that he has is, "The future has arrived, it's just not evenly distributed yet." When you walk into a government agency, not all, but some government agencies, it's like you're coming in the door from the future, because you are using techniques that look like they're risky or haven't been proven, but they've actually been used in industry for a really long time. So if you have used any of these techniques, and I would guess almost all of you have used at least one, like the cloud or user-centered design, then you probably have some of the knowledge and experience that could really make something critically better within the government. So I want to drill down on just one of these and tell a story about it. I want to concentrate on bug bounties. Bug bounties have been around since 1995. It is not controversial to have Microsoft or Chrome or Facebook pay to find security vulnerabilities. It's much better that the company get those vulnerabilities, those security holes, those bugs, instead of somebody selling that on the black market to somebody else. So it's not a surprise. It's time tested. It's industry proven. It's not the sort of thing that's really all that risky. But it looked really risky to the government. The government had never done a federal bug bounty before. So we said, okay, why don't we be the first? And by the way, people were super scared about doing this. Someone specifically said, whatever you do, don't call it Hack the Pentagon. So of course, we had to call it Hack the Pentagon. To the people in the government, it looked like something that was going to cause all kinds of problems. It might show up on the front page of the Washington Post or the New York Times. We knew that it was a really good experiment to run. And here are the results of that experiment. Over 3 years, the previous way of doing things had uncovered 30 bugs. In 24 days, they found 138 bugs. And it brought in an entirely different set of folks, the sort of folks like people in this room who might want to help the government find a security hole so that it can get locked down and be more secure, but who might not normally think about doing government service. So for example, this is a 17-year-old. His name is David Dworkin. He reported the first vulnerability in this Hack the Pentagon challenge. He did it in 13 minutes. This is the former Secretary of Defense, Ash Carter. And this is a guy who is clearly wearing a shirt that says, "All your base are belong to us." This is the sort of thing that I love to see. By the way, the team at the Department of Defense insists on wearing hoodies and t-shirts, like my Millennium Falcon with red, white, and blue, and hoodies. So I have a picture of Ash Carter, the former Secretary of Defense, pinning a medal on the head of our agency, Chris Lynch, while he's wearing a hoodie. This is the sort of thing that really warms my heart. And if you look at the results in terms of money, the federal government in the previous 3 years was paying about roughly a used car for every security vulnerability that they found. Whenever we ran Hack the Pentagon, they were paying $1,086 on average for each vulnerability. And it looked scary the first time that we ran it, and we got really good results. So we said, let's turn this crank a few more times, get people comfortable with doing this. So we ran Hack the Army. In Hack the Army, they found a vulnerability in the recruiting system that was so severe that they thought briefly about shutting the whole system down and going back to pen and paper. I'm not kidding, by the way. But the fact that it was a white hat security researcher who reported this because it was part of this program meant that they were able to find and shut down the bug, which was a router hadn't been patched, and so people were able to bounce off of that and get to the internal net and then find a whole lot of really interesting information. They were able to shut that vulnerability, which could have been an extremely severe problem. And then we'd ran Hack the Air Force. So by the time we've done several of these, people are like, wow, there's actually a lot of interest. People want to run bug bounty programs throughout the entire federal government, which is fantastic because it's a great deal. By the way, I just had to throw this in. This is another 17-year-old. I think his name is Jack Cable. I think he made $40,000 from the Hack the Air Force bug bounty. It's still a huge deal for the government because they find security holes that, you know, they would pay a lot more money for otherwise. Okay, I'll hand it back to Raquel.
Thank you. True about the dress code. When I first went to the VA, there is a door where you walk into our kind of open office area, and there's a piece of paper that has a dress code, and it's like a lot of text. But in particular, there's a line that says, "No jean pants." And I looked around and like almost everyone's wearing jeans. And I guess our response to that was to make buttons that are denim in the background and say "no jean pants" and wear them around. But we wear jeans. A couple other things that we're doing across multiple agencies that to try to just improve how software is built and deployed. So one thing we're doing at the VA, we don't have the money for like leather jackets that Google SREs get. Those are really awesome. But we are building a shared SRE team. And their job, or their mission, it's just getting started, is not just to help us run a tight ship on best.gov, but to kind of advance the state of the art across the VA and help teams not live in those worlds that I showed you earlier. Because honestly, the developers who work in those conditions deserve better, just like the characters in a dystopian novel deserve water and food. So it's really exciting to see that the people on our DevOps team or SRE team, whatever they're calling themselves, they come from big companies like Google SREs, they come from small startups, and they're just sharing knowledge and making things easier. One of the things that they're doing is, this is happening both at the Department of Health and Human Services and at the VA, and I'm sure other agencies, is like people, government will say, "Hey, we need to stand up our own servers for this thing," and we're like, "Well, actually, you don't have to buy those servers. You could just use AWS." And they're like, "What? It's horrifying." And little by little, we get there and actually help them deploy things safely and securely and make things a whole lot easier. We're also encouraging an API-first strategy. At Google, just one of many examples, a few years back, they decided to build a URL shortener, goo.gl. GL is Greenland. I didn't know that. And what did they implement first? This UI? No. They first built an API that would take these URLs and shorten them, and then they built a UI to consume it. So we're encouraging that in government. At the VA, there's that team, those teams A, B, and C that I talked to you about, they do some amazing work where they are They are consuming all these legacy backend services that use SOAP protocols and other acronyms that I don't really understand and probably never will. And they're reconciling data from multiple systems of record. For instance, it turns out there is no single canonical place where a veteran's identity is stored. And so they were doing things like reconciling all that and serving like a canonical object in, with a REST API that tells you this is a veteran's profile. This is what we know about you as a veteran. And we're working really closely with them on the API design because we need it. And we're actually having them consume their own API that they're building with some of the tools they already have live. We're helping, encouraging them to write Swagger documentation. We're debating how granular these endpoints should be, just even talking about what the request and response bodies should look like, and essentially just trying to like change the ecosystem. The Department of Health and Human Services took this a step further. So there's a program called Quality Payment Program. We need doctors to participate in Medicare so that people can get the care they need. And we have to make it easy for them to do that, but it hasn't been in the past. In the past, you have to show that, prove with data that you are satisfying certain requirements, and then you are able to get paid. To make this easier, the digital service team over there said, let's publish an API so that all the third-party developers in this healthcare market can submit the data through whatever interface that they're building for, so that doctors can say, here's the care that I've provided, and then we can spit back what they need to be approved for it and to get paid. And it's not one of those, like, if you build it, they will come things necessarily when you build an API. So it wasn't quite clear whether the market would be ready for this and pick it up. But they were ready. It turned out that even before the official launch, over 50% of the people in this market already asked for API keys. So it's this encouraging this API-first strategy, which could unlock a lot of private sector innovation and have an effect even beyond government.
Oh, yeah. All right. So time for the lightning round, because we've only got about 5 minutes left. Okay. I will give you a low light and a highlight. I won't tell you what agency this is from, but I don't know how you do your code check-ins. When I do my code check-ins, it goes through a security review or a code review process, and then you just check it in, and integration and testing and you know all that sort of good stuff happens. That's a modern technology company, right? I won't tell you the agency, but we ran across a government group where if you wanted to change 5 lines of code, you had to cryptographically sign an Adobe PDF. Oh, I'm just getting started. And then send that to up to 10 other people who also had to cryptographically sign a PDF. Along the way, you had to assert all of these different things, like code is maintainable. Yes. there was no like testing harness or anything along those lines. You just had to run the test yourself by hand. And one of my favorites, oh God, it's so bad. You can just read through these. Have you ensured there are no cross-site scripting vulnerabilities? You're just like, the QA department was like, we are throwing you developers under the bus right now. We're going to make you assert all of these things. And by the way, they also said there are no XSS vulnerabilities, and then earlier they had said, do you have no cross-site scripting vulnerabilities? So they were literally asking the same question twice. When we pointed that out, they're like, oh, you just made our release process more efficient. Thank you. I also like the second one. Has the designer ensured the application use functions known to be vulnerable to buffer overflows? That's like a trick question. It seems like you should not use those functions if they're known to buffer overflows. And this was all in the PDF that you had to fill out. And they made it better by making an Excel spreadsheet out of it. Okay, so that's a low light. This is a highlight. The work is not always easy. So we spent over a year working on trying to help immigration and naturalization so that people can become citizens much more easily. So there's a particular form called an N-400 form, and we digitized that. And so we wanted to make a cake to celebrate that this new form was digitized, and the grocery store refused to do it. They're like, why do you want to put a government form on a cake? That sounds really suspicious. We don't trust you at all. Which led somebody on the team to say, you need to fill this out in triplicate. So the grocery store literally insisted. They were like, you need to have a letter on official Department of Homeland Security letterhead that says you're allowed to put this government form on a cake. Well, we have a team at Homeland Security, so we wrote that letter, and we're like, we are hereby allowed to put the N-400 form on a cake for celebratory purposes. So as you can see, we got that to happen. So now here's the part where I get to what has been our secret or ulterior motive all along. Our previous administrator, Mikey Dickerson, used to say, on my planet, I'm normal. We all feel pretty normal in this room, but we actually have superpowers. We have superpowers that could make a really big difference for regular people in government. So one very quick example. This was a map that was used by the Small Business Administration. There's a thing called historically underutilized businesses, or hub zones. If you locate your business in a particular spot, you can get a little bit of a break, like 3 or 4% on federal contracts. The problem is the map looks like MapQuest exploded and vomited all over 1995's browser, right? If you tried to use this, I guarantee you could not click and zoom in on your hometown. So we literally just did an overlay. In this case, it was a Google map, but like you can click and drag and zoom just like you would expect to be able to participate in this program. So whenever I worked at Google, Larry Page used to say, the easiest thing to do is the same thing you did yesterday. But it's also one of the riskiest things to do. It's easy to get in a rut. And I know that, speaking, you know, having worked at Google for 16 years. So if you look back on what you got done in the last week or even the last month, and it doesn't feel like it was especially meaningful, maybe consider doing something different. We do short tours of duty, 3 months, 6 months, we prefer for a year in DC. And I gotta tell you, I am swimming in hairy, bipartisan, hugely impactful problems that affect millions of people. And what I'm not swimming in right now is SREs and software engineers. So load this URL up in your browser. We have a report we do to Congress. And by the way, Raquel and I will probably be down at the booth. We have a booth down in the expo until 2 o'clock when they close. So if it's at all interesting, maybe consider doing something a little different for a while, because the skills that you have right now could help a ton of people to make the US government better. Thank you.
Thank you.